Welcome to Saltivation. The Saltivation Show is a podcast series featuring the leading voices in salt, where we talk about the issues and strategies to help you make sense of state and local tax. Right, Stacey and I have had, you know, kind of multiple conversations associated with Public Law 86272. I think we each have our favorite component that is like the, are you kidding me? Like section of like what I can't apply for a job on a website if it's right. not solicitation right. related. So that's my personal favorite of the come on components of that kind of expansion.
Part of what I struggle with a little bit, and maybe, you know, we're just commiserating a little bit here, is the fact that the MTC says this was, you know, they put this out and they said this was an interpretation that everybody, all the states had, right, or the MTC had, right, all along. It's just updating the interpretation because it's trying to, you know, bring it into the 21st century, given, you know, the digital economy. And I agree with you guys, right, that it's, well, that's not what the law actually says. So I think that that's where I struggle with advising even clients as to, okay, well, we know this is out here. We know that this is, you know, that the states are starting to glom onto this. So we're kind of in a holding pattern in some of these states. And again, thankfully, you guys have, you know, shaken it up a little bit with the FTB. But like I said, we've got, and like we all know, there's other states that are going to just jump on board, jump on this bandwagon, and then we'll have to determine what do we do with that.
Yeah, and if I can just riff on that for a second, I think that's a good observation. And yes, these do sometimes end up being group therapy sessions for practitioners who are just frustrated. But yeah, I mean, a fundamental difference that the MTC doesn't seem to appreciate and that these states don't seem to appreciate between the Wayfair context and Public Law 86272 is the source of the rule. And it's one thing for the Supreme Court to say, We created a rule in 1992. Now we're in 2018. Yeah, we don't like our rule as much as we did then. I mean, you can, or the composition of our court has changed sufficiently so that we no longer have 5 votes in favor of that rule. But regardless, I mean, I know Justice Kennedy was the swing vote and he changed his mind. But at most, that's the U.S. Supreme Court saying under difference, a rule that we made is no longer viable under the current system. And all that that did was open the door to states to engage in their own legislation under an economic nexus standard. And if they do that, and if it's clear enough, then we may grumble, but we have rules to follow. But to suggest that Congress, through an affirmative act in 1959, did something relating to internet to e-commerce is frankly absurd. And I do not think that the composition of the current court would be receptive to an argument that, given their predilection for interpretations that relate to, well, business activities means what it meant in 1959, not what it might mean in 2018. And I do think that whatever frustrations the MTC and its membership and the states may have, that's something they need to take up with Congress if they want to change the rules.
I'm curious how this might get audited by states in the future. How, you know, are auditors going to just get on a website and say, oh, I can actually apply for any job possible. So therefore, you know, Public Law 86272 is out the window. I'm just very curious how it's going to get audited.
Yeah, no, it's very challenging. And that was one of the more chilling things that the FTB suggested in some of their pleadings was, well, it doesn't really matter whether we tell you what we're going to do or not. If our auditor decides that they did an audit and they discovered that you have marketing cookies, there's nothing to stop them from basing an audit on that finding alone. And that's why I'm hopeful, whether it's in this case or in future litigation, I'm not to put Paul in any kind of a position, but yeah, I mean, we're looking ahead at New York and New Jersey to see what our options are for bringing the fight to those states as well.
One, do you think that, you know, New York has, you know, a factor presence threshold standard of $1 million for corps? Can't recall if it's been adjusted for inflation like California does. I think New Jersey have
New
one
Jersey
too with their whole CBT stuff.
Well, they just married up their Wayfair nexus with their corporate.
So mm-hmm. if they would kind of use, do you think they would use kind of that threshold as an out of, well, or is it even possible to use that threshold standard as an out for, it's like, okay, well, yes, public law 86272 says this, but if you don't exceed our threshold, you know, that kind of protects a small business. Do you think there's any, do you think that would work?
That's an excellent question. I have heard that argument, and I do anticipate seeing that argument from the agencies to say, well, it's one thing what California did. I mean, New Jersey's in an interesting position, slightly different, but also was because they're purporting to be interpreting a new statute, but they also did this through a guidance document and not a promulgated regulation. So there may be an APA issue in New Jersey as well. And I don't know how that would shake up, but I do anticipate states like as you, the like New York and New Jersey, as you've described, who are in a better position to say what's the real harm. We've taken care of the smaller folks, and we're really only talking about sizable businesses who have the capacity. But at the end of the day, I don't think there's a but it's not really going to hurt anyone exception to federal law, at least not this federal law. I mean, there are de minimis standards that can apply in some parts of the law, but I think it's a pretty black and white issue whether you define something as a business activity or not.
Yeah, and I think I've shared this little quip on, you know, a previous episode is, right, California was one of the first states to implement kind of like a factor presence threshold back in, this is well over 10 years ago at this point. And I was working with a taxpayer who we were no longer physically present. We had a kind of remote sales into the state. It was not a good, so we weren't protected under public law 86272, but there was no physical presence in the state of California. We were well below their sales threshold, no property, no payroll. Got a notice, wrote a letter. 1 year was accepted under those terms. The next year got the next letter, wrote the same facts. They're like, nah, we're good. You're doing business. Give us your $800 minimum. And because there's always like that little carve out that says this, or you know what? We're just going to say that you're doing business because you're doing, you know, you're engaging with some customer in the state. And for us, it was the $800 minimum, not worth arguing, not pushing. So we're just going to file the return. But, you know, there are all of these rules, but at the same time, it's up to the human to interpret that. And they're still going to just kind of assess it, and it's not worth the fight. So kind of economic threshold or factor presence threshold be damned. They're still going to do, you know, whatever they want on some of those small businesses, or they could.
Yeah, and I'm not speaking from personal experience, but I have secondhand knowledge of some similar situations where a file was handed from one auditor to another, and the position changed, and the only thing that changed was who held the file.
The person reviewing it,
yeah.
Right?
So, I don't want to be unsympathetic to these folks. They're asked to do some complicated legal analysis. I would venture to say, actually, this one isn't especially complicated.
Well, and I think this is, Stacey loves tracking this one and loves a good old Joyce Finnegan conversation, but also within the MTC, you know, those revisions kind of threw in Finnegan. Does that kind of opportunity even make public law 86272 protections kind of void in general? Now, the state would have to kind of probably enact combined filing, and it would have to be applicable. But, you know, is that just another way of, you know, abolishing any sort of 86272 protections?
And this is a question that's taking me a little farther afield from my own area of expertise than the other issues we've been talking about. I mean, as a matter of law, I don't believe it should. I also understand that if everyone adopted a Finnegan approach, then it might mitigate the problem. I mean, that would be another way of having a set of rules that everyone could more or less understand and follow. But I do think it fails to, it's a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? It's their sort of bit utopian vision of the states. I mean, I guess the MTC is a utopian vision in itself of the states acting in coordination to sort of implement a federal standard without having a federal standard. And ultimately, I don't think that's realistic. And I do think that there are businesses of a size and a capacity, like ACMA members, like a number of our clients, for whom simplicity is in itself a virtue, and know it. They want to know where the line is so that they don't cross it. And if you look in the record of the California litigation, Crutchfield Corporation was kind enough to provide some evidence to support our position that we were allowed to maintain the case. And they have a very clear policy, as articulated in some of their testimony, that they tell their employees, if you're outside of Virginia, don't be doing any Crutchfield stuff, basically, because it's a clear rule that they can follow. And it's a sizable business, but it's not an enormous business. And they've been very successful following that model. And I think that's, from my perspective and my experience, that's what the folks I'm talking to care about the most.
Yeah, I think, when I was looking through the MTC guidance, and I actually sat in on some of the hearings just to kind of hear what taxpayers were saying. And it's just fascinating to really kind of go through that. And at the end of the day, the guidance really didn't change since it was even introduced after even all the hearings. And I felt like the Finnegan, kind of throwing the Finnegan in, was a little bit of a gotcha and not maybe getting a lot of publicity, whereas the PL86272 interactive website activities were getting all of the, they were the showstoppers. Completely understand that. But I guess what I'm saying is that I felt like they snuck in the Finnegan, which again, to Meredith's point, really only applies in a combined setting. But I do think it could pull a lot of taxpayers in and or be surprising. And I did notice that New Jersey made it very clear that they adopted Finnegan, in their most recent changes. So I just wonder if we'll see more of that too. Just, an added layer of this public guidance 6272. If the nail's not in the coffin because of interactive websites, right? At least, on the surface, we're going to sneak it in with Finnegan.
No, I certainly would anticipate that, because I think the more aggressive states, the New Jerseys, the Californias, are looking for ways to put it bluntly, perhaps too bluntly, sort of looking for ways to expand their tax base to include folks who aren't located in those states, because mm-hmm. That's a politically savvy way of increasing your revenue.
Absolutely. And we see that happen far too often.
Well, and as we kind of wrap up, are there any kind of policies or any things that, ACMA is following from a, from a policy perspective that we think, or like a law perspective that, that they would be involved in that could protect their members or that be of interest to their members?
And before I hand it off to Paul, I just want to jump in on one legal issue, because it's top of mind for me.
Of course.
Because we're litigating this issue not on behalf of the ACMA, but it's an active one. I think the next phase of the Wayfair fight is happening at the local level, particularly in Colorado's home rule cities, as I'm sure you're well aware. I mean, talk about 40 complying with the laws of 42 plus states, now add 70 plus municipalities, who each of which has Colorado constitutional authority to construct its own legal system, and it's a huge burden. We're involved in one case out there, and on top of which they're adding that they've got the transportation fee issues and those types. So I do think, like, large municipalities taking on the roles of mini states is one area that we're active in, and I think will affect ACMA members quite profoundly, depending on how things shake out.
Yeah, well, we appreciate the participation in Colorado, right? As Colorado, Denver in particular, is Stacey and I's, home location. We've just been really kind of struggling with, you know, SUTs and compliance and what that means and how to just do all things when it comes to, you know, doing our best with the, you know, Colorado home rules. You know, we're active participants in their, you know, the Colorado Tax Auditor Coalition, those groups. But yeah, it's really tricky. And so I can appreciate that your members would also be trying to figure out, as, you know, often remote sellers trying to figure out how to comply with, you know, our lovely home rules here in the beautiful state of Colorado.
Yeah, and I'll just add one more thing, and then I really will leave it off, let Paul speak, that in the case that I was referring to, Brandon Isaacson is representing Wayfair in a case with the city of Lakewood, and the judge brought a claim against the State Department of Revenue, and the judge dismissed them out on the theory that they do not have the authority to tell Lakewood, to basically require Lakewood to participate in a statewide unified system. And so I think that provides legal authority to suggest that these really are independent sovereign tax agencies. And most of them, to their credit, have tried to participate in SUTs and tried to make it work. And I recognize it's a challenge, but there are some that haven't. And at least as far as at the state level, there's, as I read the judge's ruling, there's no lever to require the state to act in this area because they don't have the constitutional authority to do so.
Yes, these are all issues that are very near and dear to our hearts, our team's hearts, just because we are trying to maneuver through this period. And as I'm sure you guys are aware, there are other jurisdictions in the home rule system that have economic nexus statutes, regulations, et cetera, that they've been trying to enforce, even though we might not be completely on board entirely with SUTs. So we're all kind of trying to go through this and advise everybody appropriately and determine what the best course of action.
If I can jump in a little bit, from the ACMA's perspective,
absolutely.
We our approach in, as I mentioned earlier, is always to try to get a federal bill passed into law, because organizations like ours, we're very small in comparison to, say, the milk industry or something. We're serving a pretty specific constituent, and they are located throughout the states, and they're being chased by different states, and we don't have the means to chase after those states to defend them. So in these cases that we've been discussing, as well as the ACMA has also been doing extensive work on consumer privacy, which is certainly not taxation, but there's a similarity in that, not only in the fact that California has also been kind of a trailblazer in that and trying to pass consumer privacy laws that are specific to California if you are marketing into California, but also there are a whole bunch of other copycat states that are doing similar things, but their laws are a little bit different, so you got to watch what you do all over the place. So in all cases, in these two particular topics, we're always seeking federal solutions, just as a means to make it a lot more easier for our companies to do, to avoid them going out of business, because in some cases, all these tax situations have run some of our companies out of business, enable them to thrive and to enable this industry to thrive. Because right now, what we've been discussing has stunted its growth considerably.
Well, and Paul, and I know you had said, you know, issues in consumer privacy might not be tax related, but I think actually it goes back to kind of the fundamental component of 86272 and what are you doing with data, right? And so if there's, you know, consumer privacy, you can only do certain things with data, but doing certain things with data kind of voids protections under 86272. So all of the kind of things that happen behind the scene kind of are all impacting each other. And so I think it's, you know, I think it's great what ACMA is doing and kind of protecting its, you know, its members. And, you know, how could you know, just from ACMA's perspective, how can, if our listeners, how could they find you, follow you, become a member? You know, how can they assist in that advocacy that you all are doing and help, you know, pay David's fees?
Well, great. The timing is interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, we were started as primarily a catalog mailing and postal rates organization, looking out for the best interest of companies that mail catalogs. But when we took on these tax issues, as well as consumer privacy matters, we expanded our breadth to include e-commerce merchants and direct marketing companies, postcard direct mailers and the like, any kind of remote merchants, so that, as well as their suppliers. So we actually have just undergone a slight name change from American Catalog Mailers Association to American Commerce Marketing Association, whereby we continue to retain our better known acronym name, which is ACMA. So we have just launched a new website, and it is commercemarketing.org. And we can be reached easily that way in our contact information and whatever we can post on the screen here. So we would welcome any new members and feedback and problems. A lot of times I throw out the word problems because a lot of our members have joined us as a result of running into some particular problem, whether it be with somebody, a member of Congress, or some kind of legal issue. We go and chase down the answers. So that's how we got started with the whole tax situation. So a great way to start out. Send us a question. We'll get back to you and we'll start a little dialogue.
Great. Well, Paul, thank you so much for your time. David, thank you so much for joining and for, you know, your advocacy work, and look forward to, you know, following what's next. And, you know, it was a pleasure speaking with both of you and meeting you and getting to pick your brains on all the work that's happening.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it.
The pleasure's ours. Thank you.
Keep up the good fight.
Right?
Music to my ears, of course.
And this is another episode of Saltivation. Till next time. This podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended, nor should it be relied upon, as legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. You should consult with a competent professional to discuss specifics of your situation and the applicability of the information presented.